Okay, so this talk I'm calling a trapped-ion quantum architecture. Of course, I could have also called it a trapped-ion quantum computer because that's going to be the majority of the talk. But I want to point out that there's more to trapped-ion systems, especially with the control that we have now, than quantum computing. So this is a quick overview of what I'll be talking about. I know many in the audience are very familiar with trapped ions. So I'll keep the introduction brief. I'll tell you why it's a good idea to use trapped ions for these quantum physics experiments, including quantum computing. Then I'll tell you about our sort of stack, which is how do we turn a atomic physics experiment essentially into a programmable quantum system. And then I'll give some example applications, including some benchmarking experiments we did with a group at Princeton, some recent results on quantum walks and how a quantum walk can simulate a simple Dirac equation. And because I know Christina is very interested in this topic, some recent work on Schwinger model, which is kind of a first step towards quantum field theory simulations in trapped ions. And so if I have time, I'll also talk about an analog simulation that's already a couple of years old, but I think it kind of uses nicely the degrees of freedom in an ion trap that are normally not involved in a quantum computer directly, which are the phonons. And then I'll finish up by some sort of future projects that have to do with scaling this kind of approach. Okay, so why should you use ions for these quantum physics experiments, including quantum simulations and quantum computing? Well, for those, you need a qubit, and that, of course, is a very well controlled quantum system. And if you take a single atom, you isolate it from the rest of the universe, that is a very pristine candidate for this. There are energy levels within atoms, which we can use as the qubit states, and we can interact with these using laser light and fluorescence to detect their state. And often these transitions are in the ultraviolet or visible, so the experiments themselves can be at room temperature because the thermal radiation doesn't really impact them too much. Now, of course, if you want to scale the system, atoms are a great place to start because, of course, atoms are standards, which is why we use atomic clocks. So each atom of a given type is identical, which means if you want to get more identical qubits, you just add more of these atoms to your system. And so I said in the beginning, we want these well-isolated systems, but on the other hand, we also want interactions because that's how we make interesting quantum states. That's how we make quantum gates. And so here, ions are a particularly good choice because, of course, ions are charged atoms, and that means they interact strongly via the Coulomb force. And so if you trap them in a shared potential, they will form these chains that have shared motional modes. And these are quantum harmonic oscillators that you can couple the spin states to in order to create entanglement. So what's kind of the sort of vision or the big picture here? You can imagine having chains of ions that are in a larger processor. You can move them around, entangle any of them as you wish, and then build up a larger computation. Of course, not infinitely large. So perhaps this picture on the left here is a module as part of a larger system where you use photonic interconnects to connect multiple of these sort of smaller units. And of course, this is the vision, so we're not quite there yet. The main challenges are that we need higher fidelity operations. So these individual gates that we do at the moment are not really good enough to go to thousands or millions of operations. We also need to control more ions. So now people control a few ions, maybe tens of ions. But of course, that has to increase. And this is becoming increasingly important. Our classical control of these systems has to also keep pace. And so this involves everything from the compiler. How do you actually map an application to your physical hardware? But also the control signals that you need to control a larger number of qubits. And that all has to grow in step with these systems as they get improved. Now, qubit quality is not on the list here because we're doing atomic physics. So thankfully, the qubits themselves are essentially perfect. It's really our control or our lack of perfect control that's introducing errors. And so this is the ion trap that is currently operating in my lab at the University of Maryland. This is an end view. It's a pole trap. You can see this sort of blade-shaped arrangement. There's a radio frequency on two opposing blades, which traps the ions in this plane. This is about an inch on the side here. And then this is a side view. You see these segments, and they cause a weaker axial trapping potential. And with this trap, we can confine a small number of ions very reliably. I'll mention later why it's not a large number, but for numbers like this, we can control them pretty well. The ion that we use for this is ytterbium-171. One of the reasons is it has this nice qubit here in the ground level that has this property that the magnetic field quantum number is zero. So that means this qubit is magnetic field sensitive, insensitive to first order. So without really shielding or trying very hard, we get over a second of coherence time, which is a nice place to start. And so this transition here at 370 nanometers is what we use to initialize and read out our qubits. I'll very briefly mention how we do that. So if we shine in a particular laser frequency, we can optically pump to the state zero here very quickly in a few microseconds. And then at the end of a computation, we want to read out the state. So we need to distinguish state zero and state one. So a different frequency of light can actually create a cycling transition here between these two states. So this one up here and these three. And so we can discriminate between state zero, which will be a dark ion, and state one, which will be a bright ion with pretty high fidelity. And this fidelity, you know, is not limited to these numbers. Much higher fidelity has been observed by simply improving the light collection in this system. So collecting more light from the ions during the detection window allows you to make it shorter and reduce this error. Okay, the final ingredient is we need a way to manipulate our ions. And for that, we use a pulsed laser in this Raman scheme here. So the laser frequency is detuned from all of these, both of these levels up here, but the two arms are detuned from each other by the qubit splitting. And the way this is achieved is by using this pulsed laser, splitting into two parts and shifting each with respect to the other, such that each of these frequency components or comb teeth is resonant with, you know, the 107th or 108th neighbor in the other comb, in the other half. And that creates a bead node that drives this transition here. So that's basically all the basic ingredients to the system. And from that on, we can build what we call, or what a computer scientist would call, the stack. You want to run some quantum algorithms or some other application. You have a compiler that breaks these quantum circuits down into native gates, and then these are applied as laser pulses on your actual physical hardware. So I'll very briefly mention each of these steps, starting at the bottom here. So that's a sketch of our system. These dots in the center here are our ions. The trap is not shown. And these sort of purple objects are the two Raman laser beams that I introduced a few seconds ago. One of these beams hits all the ions, comes in from the back. And the second one is split into many beams. Each of them is goes through a separate channel of this multi-channel acousto-optic modulator and is then imaged onto exactly one ion. So we individually address these ions. And with this modulator here, we can choose the amplitude, frequency, and phase of each of the signals individually. Then in order to read out the state, we image the ion chain onto a multi-channel photodetector. You can see this here is channel number versus photon counts. And so that means each ion has its own detector of light. And so we can tell for each ion whether it was bright or dark at the end of a calculation, or for each qubit, whether it was in state one or state zero. Okay, let's move up one layer here. So the first thing we can do is just turn on individual single beams and create Rabi flopping on each of these qubits. And we can choose the duration and we can choose the phase of these signals to change the axis on the blosphere that we rotate around and the angle by which we rotate. And that's what we call the R gate. This is kind of the action of the gate with these two parameters. More interestingly, how do we create entanglement in the system? So if you set your laser on resonance, you get this carrier. That's the Rabi flops that I showed on the previous slide. But if you detune by a motional frequency, you get this, these sidebands. And that means you flip the spin, but you also add or subtract one phonon of motion from these motional modes. I'm only showing the first two here. Of course, there are n modes in each spatial direction for n ions. And so now it turns out if you send in a bichromatic laser field, so roughly like these arrows here, one near the red and one near the blue sidebands, you can create an interaction that looks like this. It has a spin motion, so a spin-dependent excitation of the motion and a spin-spin term. And if you shape these pulses, so if you change the Rabi frequency as you go along, you have to sort of pre-calculate how to do this. But what you basically do is at the end of the interaction, all the motion comes back to rest, and that cancels this term, and you're left with this spin-spin interaction term. Now, all the ions, of course, participate in the motion, as you can see here, but only the ions that have the laser beam or beams applied actually participate in the spin evolution. So you can selectively entangle two ions. And so if you do this, you basically get this XX gate, and this is the kind of truth table for it, or the gate action. And if we set this parameter, which is basically just given by the overall envelope of this pulse shape, if we set this to the right value, we can create a maximally entangled Bell state between any two qubits. And since this is true for any pair, we basically get full connectivity in the system. I'm showing 9 here because at the moment we're sort of experimenting with 9 ions in my lab. And so each of these gray lines is one of these gates or one of these potential interactions that you can turn on and off selectively just by programming in the pulses. And so that's advantageous for a quantum computer because if you have more connectivity, it's easier to map a given application to the actual hardware. If a connection is not directly available, you'd have to sort of copy the information through swap gates, and that creates overhead. But at least for this kind of size, we have full connectivity in the system. Okay, so now let's move up one more layer. How do we turn these native gates into sort of useful computational gates that you might find in an algorithm? I'll give one example. That's the Fredkin gate or C-swap gate, which basically swaps these two qubits conditional on the state of the first qubit. This is the truth table for the gate. And this gate you can write down in our native gate. So I don't want you to look at all the details. The main thing is each of these boxes here is either an XX gate or a rotation gate. And so the compiler, basically, if you tell it to run a Fredkin gate, will just play back this sequence of gates. Of course, it'll fill in various calibration parameters here to get all these angles right. And then you can create a Fredkin gate in the system. So here you see all the input states versus output states, and it matches the truth table for the Fredkin gate. Not perfectly, of course. So you see the fidelity is like around 86-87%, and that's for 7 two-qubit gates. Two-qubit gates are really the most expensive gates, or the one that has the most error. So we typically get 1-2% error in the system. And that is mainly caused by intensity noise during the gate. So I said we have to sort of excite and de-excite the motion. And if there's noise during that process, that doesn't happen perfectly. The spins stay a little bit entangled with the motion, and we don't measure the motion, so we trace it out. So we end up in a bit of a mixed state, and that causes our error. Okay, so now we've essentially reached the top layer here, and I'll move on to some recent applications. Unless there's some questions, I'm happy to be interrupted, by the way. I can't see anyone, but if anyone has a question until up to now, please let me know. Okay. So applications. So I know that Rajibul and Crystal are working on building a user facility. And so I thought I'd keep these slides in because I think that's such a great idea and there's a lot of demand for it. So this is a very small quantum computer. And ever since we kind of started it.
Just a second. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but Ray just had a question. So which
is okay. What's the origin of the spam errors?
Yes.
Yes, okay, so this is a good question. And there are two things that I have to say here. I'll go one back to here, okay? So one is that discrimination doesn't work perfectly, okay? You can see there's a little bit of a tail here for the bright state. And that is because it is possible when you excite with this laser, it is possible to excite to this F equals one state. And from there, you can actually decay down to zero. So if you turn the detection beam on for a long time, you will actually pump your ion dark. And that's this tail here. And that you can reduce by basically just collecting for a shorter time. And you can do this by just putting a big lens near your ion and collecting the right amount of photons that you need to discriminate between bright and dark in a very short time. And so several more nines, I forget exactly how many, Jung-sang Kim holds the record for ytterbium, that can be achieved. The second source of spam error is in this device, which is crosstalk. So you can see we image onto these channels. And in fact, we image onto not onto neighboring channels, but we leave one channel free, but still we have some crosstalk of about 1% or so that happens onto these next nearest neighbor channels. And so that means, and this is actually not optical, it's actually electrical in this device. So if there's a bright channel next to a dark channel, some of the charge or some of the signal jumps over to the dark channel and makes it appear bright. And that is, if you have a large chain, that is actually a state dependent spam error. And we can, so if we take aggregate data, if we take the average population or output population of a qubit chain, we can correct for this error very well. And we do this by just taking one ion and moving it into the place of all the N ions and characterizing this very carefully. And then we can correct for it very well. Of course, for some application like error correction, where you really need the single shot answer every time, we can't do that. But for most applications, such as for characterizing this Fredkin gate, for example, we can apply or we can characterize the spam crosstalk and spam matrix and kind of invert it and correct this. And so you can see this number would be about 2% worse if we had kept those errors in.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Okay, yes, I was going to move on to these applications. And you can argue on the one hand, this is kind of a toy quantum computer with only a few qubits and it doesn't do very much, but it seems to have attracted a lot of interest from various people. And this is kind of a list of different collaborations with external theorists and others that we've had over the years that have led to publications and interesting results, or some have not been published, but most of them have. And so I think the idea of making this sort of more broadly accessible is a very good one. And of course, this is why other quantum computing providers, IBM and others, are now on the cloud, including also now IonQ is an IonTrap startup that's putting things on the cloud that allows people to actually play with these devices and getting sort of real feedback from an actual physical device for the particular algorithm or application that you might care about. Of course, those might not give you access to the various layers of the stack. And so maybe in an academic lab or a user facility, you might have the opportunity for someone to actually interact at different layers and not just at the sort of public facing layer of a web interface. And so that's been kind of an interesting journey. And I think this is just going to keep growing as we go on, as interest for using quantum computers actually grows. And so now I'm going to show a comparison paper that was published with a group at Princeton. Margaret Martinozzi is actually a computer scientist. And so what she did is basically just pick a number of small quantum applications, including the Fredkin gate is in here and some others. Bernstein-Vazirani is kind of a textbook Oracle algorithm. And we basically told her our sort of made up programming language for our experiment. And she sent us a text file, which we loaded up into our system. And ran it, and the same for various other quantum computers that were available at the time. And you can see the results for those here. The ones that have an X, we didn't actually do because we only did up to 5 qubits here. But as you can see, these dark bars, which is our system, they compare pretty favorably to the other sort of chips and devices that are out there at the moment. And of course, this looks great, but these aren't really applications that really challenge our system because they're very short depth, so only a small number of gates. And so I think if you really want to test the quantum computer, it's good to test it at a sort of a deeper level. And maybe not just using example sort of algorithms, but maybe an actual application that if scaled up, someone might actually find interesting, you know, from a physics perspective too. And so that's the next example that I'm gonna show. I'll skip this. Which is a quantum walk. Okay, so a quantum walk is basically the quantum equivalent of a classical random walk. And of course, a random walk is a game essentially where you toss a coin and based on the result of the coin toss, you either move left or you move right. And the quantum equivalent, of course, you'll throw a quantum coin, which could put you in a superposition of moving left and moving right. And that means at a later time, you can interfere with yourself. And that leads to very different outcomes from a quantum random walk to a classical random walk. But also you can map this quantum walk framework to various simulations and applications in quantum computing, which makes it very useful. And so there've been some implementations with trapped ions before using the motional modes, but we're gonna go for an implementation using an actual quantum circuit and implementing the walk sort of algorithmically. And so what you have to do is you need a position space and a coin. And that's this kind of joint Hilbert space here. And then you need to apply a coin toss operator and a shift operator repeatedly on your initial state and see what comes out. And so here we use a single qubit as the coin. This is the coin flip operator. You can change the weight of the coin with this parameter theta. And this is a shift operator, which basically tells you to move left if the coin is 0 and tells you to move right if the coin is 1. And so then this is what the algorithm will look like. You start in some qubit space for the position and the coin, and then you repeatedly apply this and then measure the outcome at the end. And so in order to create this position space, you have to kind of find a mapping between, um, between these qubit states here and the positions. Of course, you could just use one qubit per position. And that would be very inefficient though in terms of encoding. So we've chosen this particular mapping. So we have 15 spaces here on four qubits, all the way from 0 to ±7. And here's basically what these different binary states correspond to in terms of position. And if you use that mapping, you can then write down what this operator here looks like. In fact, this mapping turns out to be very, very efficient for this. And so here you can see for the different steps, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, what gates you have to apply. Controlled NOT gates, Toffoli gates, and higher order Toffolis, which tend to have a lot of two-qubit gates in them. And so what we did is we sort of did another compilation step where we compressed these gates by expressing them in our native gates and then reducing those circuits. The nice thing about the XX gate is that it has this continuous parameter. So we can't just make, you know, pi over 4, which is maximally entangling, which is kind of the equivalent of a C0 gate. You could also do the square root of a C0, which is kind of the square root of this V here. And so if you use that capability, you can actually compress these combinations of gates into much shorter circuits. Okay, so with that, we have our sequence and we can apply the quantum walk step 1, 2, 3, so and so on, and measure at each step what the outcome is. And so here are the results. Experiment is on the right, simulation is on the left. And here's if we start with the coin in state 0, you can see the particle mostly moves left. If we start with coin 1, particle mostly moves right. And if we have a superposition of 0 and 1, we get a superposition of moving left and right in this coin. So the quantum walk works, but I said earlier that this is kind of a nice framework for doing quantum simulations also. And so we are also realizing a Dirac cellular automaton, which is essentially a particle that moves as a quantum walker, but you tailor the conditions such that it realizes the dynamics of a Dirac equation. And for that, we have to modify the quantum walk very slightly. We use a split step quantum walk, which is very similar to before, except a coin toss deciding whether you go left or right. You toss two coins. One of the coins tells you whether you stand still or move left, and another coin whether you stand still or move right. And so that leads to these two coin toss operators, one left moving and one right moving. This one you can see moving left, standing still, and moving right, these two terms. And now you can rewrite this, the evolution for this, as a differential equation where you can have two wave functions, one for left moving, one for right moving. And these depend on the sort of the wave functions previously, and that you can identify with the state of either standing still or moving left or right, which are these sort of spatial differentials here. And for certain parameter choices of theta 1 and theta 2, this actually turns into different versions of Dirac equation. So if you fulfill this condition, you basically get a massless Dirac equation. And here, if you set theta 1 to 0 and for small theta 2, you can realize a massive Dirac equation. And so we did this. We basically have to run a very similar circuit to before, except now we have two different coins here, theta 1 and theta 2, which we have to set to the right values. And these are the results from that experiment. You can see that start at the bottom here. This is for a very small mass. So in that case, the particle kind of just zooms off left or right, depending on the coin, of course, as fast as it can, essentially. However, if you make the particle heavy, it does not just zoom away quickly. Instead, it kind of wobbles around in the middle and interferes with itself. And so in this way, you can see that for a small quantum walk, you can sort of use it to do an actual physical simulation of an equation that you might actually be interested in. And so what's nice is we get a pretty good result, even though we did, you know, about 40 entangling gates all the way to the fifth step. But we still reproduce the expected dynamics pretty well in the system. Okay, I'll move on to a Schwinger model, unless someone has a question. Maybe I'll wait for another chat post. Or someone can just speak if you want.
No, but I can have a quick question.
Yeah.
For your quantum walk, is it possible to actually bring the particle back, like something like a Bloch oscillation, if you tilt your, basically add a bias to your quantum walker?
Oh yeah, I guess you could. Yeah, we didn't do that. But I think for that, you would have to just change what the coin does at some point later or something, right? You'd have to sort of bias the coin and maybe make it time dependent.
Yeah, if you just add a force essentially, then you can effective force. So yeah.
I think that could be doable. So you can obviously add more operators either by biasing the coin or by changing the shift operator. So you could also make the shift operator imbalanced, I guess. Instead of those C knots and Toffolis, you could have an imbalanced C knot or Toffoli that makes it more, you know, more likely for a given probability that you apply, makes an imbalanced shift. I think you could. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that. But that's, I guess that's another option you have for implementing a different quantum morphs.
Thanks.
Okay, so I'll move on to the Schwinger model. And so that is sort of a very simple simple way, you know, it's kind of approaching quantum field theory with quantum computers. Of course, it's kind of a tentative first step, and that's because it's a very simplified model. But of course, quantum field theory turns out to be hard to simulate on classical computers, so it seems like a promising application for quantum computers in the future. So the Schwinger model is basically a 1 plus 1D quantum field theory on discretized space. Basically, you have these lattice sites on which you have either electrons or positrons, and you can map this system connected by these gauge bosons, and you can map the system to a spin chain. And our kind host here written a paper a couple of years ago, which sort of maps this out and explains this very clearly for how you would do this to map to a trapped ion system. So you have either a vacancy or a positron on odd sides, either an electron or a vacancy on even sides. And then you do the Jordan-Wigner transformation to get to spins. You make some gauge choices and you end up with this kind of lattice Hamiltonian. You have to apply Gauss's law, which imposes a constraint for the electric fields. And that means there's kind of a subspace of your spin states that are allowed. So the number of spins, of spin ups that you initialize, that has to be conserved in order to fulfill this law. And that actually leads to some nice post-selection you can do later. If errors make your simulation leave the code space, you can discard those and actually improve your result as a result of this symmetry. And so then you end up with this final Hamiltonian in a spin basis or qubit basis, which includes the fermion mass, a Hopping term, and this E-field interaction term. And as a result of integrating out these gauge bosons, you end up with long-range interactions. So you can see there's this square term here. So that means you will have sigma z interactions that are non-nearest neighbor, but instead long-range. And that's basically the price you pay for dealing with this bosonic degree of freedom. However, since we have ions, I think this is a pretty good choice because ions do afford us long-range interactions in our systems. And so then you take this Hamiltonian, you trotterize it, and you show that you can sort of follow the evolution of the Schwinger model using a quantum computer. And so we started by a one-site model. So one spatial site means one electron, one positron site. You start in a vacuum state, and you can observe pair creation and annihilation. And this is the circuit essentially for one trotter step. And just applying this again and again leads to this evolution. And so I'll show on the next slide what the actual results are. We took some data on this before the shutdown happened, which wasn't so great, but it's been kind of a bit of a fight to get back to the lab. And now things are working again. And just in the last month, we took some new data on this. So this is kind of the probability of the vacuum state, which oscillates. So the straight line is the exact solution. The blue line is the trotterized evolution, which is basically what a perfect quantum computer would give you. And the experimental data is in yellow. And you can see we have some decay here. And that's because we're doing a lot of gates. So this is step 20. Each step, as you can see here, has each step has two gates. And we're doing kind of two steps per unit time. So that means this is already four steps per unit. So this is 80 XX gates. So this has decayed quite a bit. However, I told you before, we have the symmetry in the system, which we can use to throw away some of our data, where we know the simulation has left states that are valid in terms of a physical model. And so if we apply this post-selection, you can see we recover quite a lot of the contrast. And almost all the way to the end, we get a very good representation of the exact evolution of the Schwinger model. This is only two qubits, but it's sort of, you know, the smallest Schwinger model you can do, but we still get a good simulation here. Now let's move on to a slightly larger system, two sites, and you can see the circuits grow. And also crucially, non-nearest neighbor interactions come in. So these are these kind of longer range terms that I talked about before. And now I'm showing here a certain ordering of these gates. You can see these gray, red, and blue, and these terms don't commute. But when you trotterize, you actually have a choice on how you do this, how you order these terms before you turn it into a circuit. And so this is not data, this is just theory. It tells you, so this is the exact dynamics that we expect, but depending on what choice of term ordering you do, you can get different results. And so you can see we chose a very sort of large trotter step size here. That's because we know we don't have that many gates. But if you, instead of ordering X, Y, Z, you use a different order, which is basically what we call even odd ordering, where you basically do this gate and then this gate followed by this gate and so on. Just by reordering those terms, you basically represent the same physical evolution with a different trotter approximation. You can get a lower error from most of these points. And so this is what we chose to use, these blue points rather than the red. And so I'll switch to the next slide where you're going to see data. The blue curve is still going to be there. So that's going to be the exact curve and this trotter curve, as well as the post-selected data. So this is exact trotterized. And then the green is the experimental data after post-selection. And you can see for the first two flops, it does what it's supposed to do. But of course, at the end, you can see again, a lot of XX gates, we get some damping due to these errors. So this is, we did one trotter step per unit of time. So after 10 units of time, it's 10 trotter steps. Each of them has nine XX gates. So after 90 gates, 90 entangling operations, of course, we see some decay. But still we can, get a representation of the exact evolution. So that's what we've done so far. Of course, we'd like to move on. So I'll show you the circuit for three sites. This is half the circuit and this is the other half. You can see more long range gates are coming in. We haven't done it yet. We'll see how far we get in terms of our sort of gate depth that we can achieve. This is the same theory plot as before for different trotter order. You can see here the difference is not so big, a small difference. My guess is we'll probably not get to the last flop here, which is where the difference really matters. But yeah, we're going to take the data hopefully this month or next, and we'll see how far we go with the coherence in our system. But it's kind of a first, I would say, step for us into this field of simulating simple quantum field theory models with our quantum computer. But these are of course challenging, as you can see. So as the model grows, the effort you have to make on your quantum computer grows quite rapidly. Okay, I'll give one more example along those lines, and that is scattering in a quantum easing model. And so, of course, eventually one would like to take a quantum computer and analyze, LHC data and understand scattering processes in high energy physics, but we have to start somewhere. And so we're going to start with a very simple model, that's the quantum easing model. And so we're going to specialize this to a single particle. And if you make this coupling term or hopping term smaller than this, you can sort of approximate it by this XXYY term here. And we're going to add a potential barrier. So the idea is you have a particle that evolves under this Hamiltonian and hits a potential barrier, and we're going to observe a scattering amplitude. So we're going to have one wave function that gets scattered on this potential and one that gets transmitted. And that's kind of the model that we're going to observe. If we map to two qubits, this is basically what it looks like. You have the potential barrier here, and the initial state is going to look like this. This is a kind of the wave function, and this has a momentum that moves towards the barrier. And so then we're going to have, again, a trotterized evolution. So there's a preparation step for this initial state. Then this is a trotter step, which corresponds to this Hamiltonian, including the potential barrier. And then at the end, we're going to look at the QFD. We're going to do a two-qubit QFD, and we're going to see forward and backward momentum. And we can compare that between when we turn this potential on and off, and that will give us this phase shift in this model. And so here, there's some data. I didn't make the plot, our collaborator did. So there's some data from IBM also. So let's first look at the red and the black symbols. So the red is when the potential is active and the black when the potential is off. And so you can see this phase shift here corresponding to scattering on this potential. The exact evolution is this dashed and straight lines. And so our collaborator is Yannick Maurice at the University of Iowa, and so they also ran this on a superconducting system, which is the IBM Böblingen chip. And you can see in this run, it didn't come out particularly well because the evolution with the potential on also has this dropout here, and you can't really tell the phase shift. However, just today they sent me a result. They did it on a newer chip of IBM, and they got a much better outcome. So I just want to say this as a disclaimer. This is not the best IBM results they can do. And actually, it looks very similar to our results on this for this particular problem. Okay, this is sort of another example of how you can use a quantum circuit to do a simple, approaching, I would say, high energy physics and with the system. Okay, I'll move on to a different topic. Let's see if there's any questions.
Yes, we do have a question.
Oh yeah, there's a chat. Let me see.
Are the fidelities of 2-qubit gates better for nearby ions?
No, in fact, it depends. So there are actually some, if you imagine a 5-ion chain, there's one mode which goes like this. You see, there's one mode which really couples these two very strongly. Mm-hmm. So even though these ions are very far, there might be a very good interaction between them. And for our system, for reasons that maybe I should explain, it's not as systematic. So the big, I would say, error or inaccuracy for us is that we have this array of equally spaced beams, and the ions are not equally spaced. They are in a harmonic trap, so the outer ions are further apart than the inner ions. And normally you can correct for this. You can add more electric fields, you can add a quartic term and so on to make the ions pretty equally spaced. But our trap, which is kind of a hand assembled trap with various manufacturing defects, we can't do this. So we instead add some ions on the end to make the middle ones more equally spaced, but we also have a gradient in the spacing. It's a bit of a mess. So some ions just have more intensity noise than others. And so which gates are better or worse is in our case a bit more, you know, what of random.
Yes.
Okay, let's see.
There's another question.
Have you benchmarked your results against analog simulation? Analog simulation of the Schwinger model, you mean? Or I don't think directly. Wait, more chats. Yes. Ah, okay. Not directly. I know, of course, the Innsbruck Schwinger model. Christine can probably talk more about it. We haven't directly run the exact same evolution that they did to compare. Let's see, more chat. What is the primary source of decay in a digital simulation? I think it's gate error. Every time we do a gate, we have a little bit of a mixed state, and that means we get damping of the signal. And some of it will spill into other states that are inside the simulation space, so we can throw those away. But some of them will just obviously spill into the same. So even if you do this post-selection, eventually it'll also decay. And so I think this is what limits our gate depth. And so I would like to get to a trap where we have better gates. At the moment, all the really good gates that have been done in ions, the world record breaking gates of 99.9 fidelity, they're all in these, you know, 2-qubit ion chains. So it would be nice to be able to push this kind of performance also for ions in a chain and be able to do these circuits efficiently on, you know, with large gate depth.
Oh yes, that would open up so many possibilities. Yes.
Yeah, I agree. I'll talk a little bit about at the end about what would be my dream ion trap to hopefully do this. Maybe Christina, do you want to say something about comparing with the analog simulation?
So I mean comparing the trotter evolution that you're doing now as compared to what we did in 2016.
Yeah.
Well, we had an entirely different trotter protocol, right? Mm-hmm. And it was made with completely different goals in mind. But what I found now very exciting looking at yours is that you get so much of the time evolution, like you saw really several flops, and that was exciting for me to see.
Mm-hmm.
But I see there's another question coming up. Okay. From Ray, what is the main challenge to make better 2-qubit gates? And let me also say that we unmuted everybody. You're absolutely welcome.
You can just talk. It doesn't seem like a lot of people are trying to talk at the same time. So what's the key to making 2-qubit gates better? So I think the key is two things. One, you want to make them more robust. Two, these drifts that we have in the system. One is intensity noise. Another one is mode drift. I haven't really talked about that either. So of course, we're using the radial modes in order to do these excitations. And the radial modes are generated by this RF potential. RF field oscillating, and that of course is not super stable. It does drift around as the thermal expansion of the resonator and so on. It means those modes shift over time, and the gates that we have are a little bit robust to that. So if you shift only by half a kilohertz, it's fine. But if it shifts by a kilohertz or more, you can really see the fidelity goes down. But people are now designing gates, especially multi-tone gates. So instead of just two frequencies, you use multiple frequencies that are actually robust to this kind of error. So that are kind of the fidelity is kind of flat if you detune the frequency by several kilohertz. And that will make, if you calibrate the gates, it'll just make the good calibration persist for much longer. And I think there are more schemes to be discovered that actually make things, give you robustness to other errors, including intensity noise that we have in our system. But I think it's a two-pronged approach. One is make it passively more stable. So make a trap where the ions actually have the right spacing and are not sitting on the edge of the beam and subject to all this vibration, that vibrations don't really cause intensity noise. And number two is sort of engineering these pulses better to give higher, more robustness. And I think a combination of those will lead to better gates and deeper circuits. Okay, let's see. So I'll make the next chapter quick, but I do want to mention it. And that's because it uses, I think, instead of just doing quantum computing with these spins and ignoring the motional modes or just using them as a bus, you can also use these degrees of freedom that the motional modes give you to do some interesting work. And so I told you earlier that we have these normal modes. They're like modes on a guitar string in these ions. But think about what happens when you take an ion chain and you just flick one of the ions, okay? You just give it a kick. Of course, what's gonna happen is it's gonna excite the neighboring ions. This is not an eigenstate of the system, so you're gonna have dynamics. And so one way to think about this is you just have now, instead of a big harmonic oscillator of all these ions in a chain, you have individual little harmonic oscillators. Each ion is a local harmonic oscillator coupled to all its neighbors. So that now we're kind of going into this local mode picture where you don't have the normal modes, but each ion has its own little mode and a coupling constant to its neighbor. So what happens if you just excite one phonon in this resonator here, it's gonna couple and hop to the neighboring resonator or neighboring resonators. And so this is the Hamiltonian to describe this. Here you have the resonators and here you have coupling constants. And this, this goes as a distance to the third because it's kind of a dipole coupling. They're kind of oscillating transversely and leading to an oscillation on the neighbor. And so this is something that we actually observed. And so you can see here, let's start on the right. We put a local phonon on ion three and observed it hopping to ion two and back. We did the same on ion one, it hopped to ion two and back. It doesn't hop perfectly. You see the contrast is not very high. And that's because, again, asymmetries in the trap mean that we have some shift between these frequencies. So the resonators are not fully resonant with each other. So you get a bit like an off-resonant flop. And that means you don't flop all the way. If you put a phonon in the middle, you get superpositions of flopping left and right. And that's what you see here. You're flopping both left and right at the same time. Okay, but now we don't just have these harmonic oscillators coupled. We also have a spin or a qubit at each location. And we can couple those. We know how to couple them because we couple them for the gates all the time. We have to put on a laser beam that couples the spin and the motion. And so if we do this, we get a new set of eigenstates, which are called phonon-polariton states. And now the energy spacing is not just given by the oscillator frequency, but also by the laser intensity. And now you can see this first excited state is not resonant with this one. So that blockades hopping onto this state. So you can selectively turn off hopping by blockading the phonon from hopping from this ion to that ion, instead moving to the other side. So that's the kind of James Cummings type Hamiltonian that you apply in addition. And so that's kind of the experimental sequence. We cool the ions, we prepare a phonon here, then we wait, we blockade one of them and we see if it hops to the other side and then we measure where the phonon is. And so here you can see we blockade the middle ion, ion two, and the phonon stays on ion three, cannot hop over. Same over here, phonon stays on ion one. And in the middle, we can choose where to blockade. We can either blockade on the right, then the ion only hops to the left, or we can blockade on the left and the phonon only hops to the right. Okay, so the phonon acts like a particle that is hopping around and we can influence its dynamics. And so that's kind of a nice fun experiment that we did a couple of years ago, but there's actually a lot of proposals and potential applications that have been published over the years of what you could do with this system. Some of them are pretty exotic, such as Bose-Einstein condensation of phonons, right? If you imagine really making the system, making all the harmonic oscillators equal, you could imagine the phonons delocalizing. You could imagine adding disorder, starting transport, and so on. So I think this is kind of a nice system that can be used for more simulations in the future. I think I'll come to the end. Just a couple of outlooks. So what do we want in order to scale these systems up, whether we use them for simulations, fundamental studies, or algorithm implementations? Even though I made a big deal about it, no system is going to be fully connected at arbitrary lengths. At some points, if you put more and more ions in, connecting the first one and the last one is going to be slow and inefficient. So what you want is you want to have a fully connected chain over here. You might want to split up ions, move them to the other side, and then have a fully connected system over there. And that's also going to be pretty densely connected overall, though not fully connected. And maybe you want to ask for a remote entanglement resource where you sort of connect this ion to via entangled photons to another module over there. And so that means your compiler has to be very complicated, because your compiler has to decide when to split the chain, where to move it, when to ask for this. All of this has cost functions associated. So that's going to be one challenge. And the other challenge is, how do you make devices that can actually support these ion chains and manipulate them in the way you want, maybe even allow for these connections? And so I'm going to talk about two aspects of how I'm kind of planning on working on these challenges. And the first is to build a better trap. So the trap I showed you was kind of hand assembled, had all these defects. And one way many people are going is actually using these surface traps that you see on the bottom left here. They're nice. They have the disadvantage that the ion is really trapped very close to a surface, which adds a bunch of noise, also not trapped very deep. So what I think you'd really want is one of those 3D traps that we have, but not hand assembled, but instead perfectly engineered, as I say. So you make it out of one block. And so there's this company Transloom that fabricates devices from fused silica. And so basically using this laser exposure, you can selectively etch away certain areas of the glass and end up with a monolithic trap. And so here you can see some pictures of a first test setup. So this is not a trap yet, but this is just a study by them to show that they can actually make these devices to the desired specifications. So this is an end view. You can see those four electrodes. Of course, you wouldn't want them this close in the end, but this is just a test. Here's what it looks from the side. And they've even done a sort of a metallization process, because of course you don't want the trap to be glass. The top layer needs to be gold or another metal in order to be conductive. And so that's, to me, is kind of a promising direction towards making a more precise trap that's also 3D. So it has all the advantages of a 3D trap, such as high optical access, deep trapping, symmetric electrodes, low heating rates, and hopefully that'll work out. So these are kind of test pieces, but the next stage in the coming year, we'll move on to actually making test traps and evaluating them in the lab. The second thing I want to briefly mention is quantum networking. Of course, the computers we all know and love have only become really good since we've connected them together in a network. And one would like to do that too with a quantum computer. However, most of the good qubits or good memories like ions have these UV or visible frequencies. And a common strategy is to convert them to telecom frequencies so we can then transmit them through optical fiber at 1550. But maybe you don't want to make, you know, a country-sized network. Maybe you want to build a city-sized network. And for that, I propose a different idea. So if this is your network node, the red circle would be how far you could go if your ions were to emit telecom photons. If they don't, then I can draw a different circle. And that's the circle where fiber loss is actually smaller than conversion loss. So if your next node is within this circle, you should just directly transmit the photon from your ion rather than convert it. And so the question is, how big is this circle? If your photon is UV, probably the circle is your lab. If it's visible, maybe the circle is your building. But if you had some near IR transition, maybe this circle would be a few kilometers and you could imagine having a city-sized network. And so this is fiber loss versus wavelength. This is, of course, the optimal window here at 1550. And I would argue probably the shortest wavelength that still makes sense to use would be in this area here. And it's kind of the lowest wavelength window where it still makes sense, because afterwards there's this peak and then it doesn't really get better. And so it turns out right here, at 1100 nanometers is actually a transition in strontium ions. So this is at 1092. And here's a scheme how you could make entangled photons at 1092 nanometers. You excite the ion up to here, and there's several possible decays. And some of them end you up in an entangled state where you have photon polarization entangled with the ion state. And so this is a experiment that I'm building at the moment. This is a sketch of the trap. It'll just be a simple four rod trap, no shuttling required here, to demonstrate this scheme and show that you can actually have an entangled photon that is still entangled after transmission through a fiber. Okay, with that, I'm going to come to the end. I want to thank a lot of people. This is my group at the moment. The work that I showed you today was done by Cynthia for the quantum walks, and Nyung, who did all the Schwinger model simulations. And then collaborators, of course, I work with Guido at Rice on the glass trap. Chandru in India has done the theory for the quantum walks. Yannick, he was our collaborator on the Ising scattering, and Zore on the Schwinger model. And of course, big thanks to Chris Monroe, from whose group my lab basically derives, and all the funding agencies. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you. So do we have questions? I know we had a lot of questions during your talk already, but do we have more questions?
Maybe I can ask one.
Yeah.
So coming back to, I think, Ray's question when he was asking about how you can make your two qubit gate better. So what's the strategy for, let's say if you want to run a quantum simulation or a quantum computation for 100 milliseconds, right? And then you also want to make sure that your whatever heating rate, it is a finite value, and you want to kind of control that heating rate. What's the strategy for that? What do you envision?
So that means you need to cool in the middle. So at some point while you're not doing gates, right, when you just have all the information is in the spins, you need to bring the temperature back down. And for that, one way to do it is to have a different species of ion in the chain. And so in Chris's lab, for example, they use barium. And the idea would be you have a coolant ion. In particular, in Chris's new experiment, the Eureka lab, where they now do these gates on longer chains, they find that the axial mode heats up very much. And that's because that's, of course, very weakly trapped, right, in this long chain. And so you think, well, we're not doing gates on the axial mode anyway, but at some point it matters because the ions are moving around like this. So that means they will change, it'll change the phase of the laser, it'll change the intensity, especially for the not perfectly aligned ions. And so one way to do that would be to basically take a broad break at some point and do a few steps of sideband cooling to cool those modes back down.
So on that similar topic, the 3D trap that you are building, is there any vision for making that compatible with the cryo setup?
So the issue, I guess, with glass is that it does not have a great, or used silica, it doesn't have a great thermal conductivity. So I haven't directly planned for putting that into a cryostat. It might be possible. In fact, Guido is working on a way to extract heat from the trap. So this is something we're kind of modeling at the moment by adding some kind of sapphire structures on the end and having a, not directly at the ion, but slightly back, have a thicker copper layer to increase the thermal conductivity. I think that's good anyway, because even when you have it in room temperature, it heats up with the RF. But we haven't really done the modeling or anything for the cryo system. Maybe there's a better material, I feel, that might be more suitable. But can you then machine it like this? So I think I would suggest it for further study. That's a good question though. I think it would be great, yeah, if you had everything cold and perfectly engineered.
Do we have more questions from the audience?
I will ask another one.
Yes.
Hey.
How are you doing?
And pretty thank good. You for the good talk. To see you.
Very nice. Many years ago, probably 20 years ago, and that probably shows my age, I visited Dave Wineland and Chris when they were in Boulder, and they had the problem with the heating of these traps. And I remember at the time they could not understand really what was the origin of this heating. So has there been any progress on understanding the heating?
I would say there has been some, but I would say mysteries still remain. In general, it is accepted that contaminants on the surface are you know, contribute to this heating, and that the heating is also thermally activated. So if you have some kind of molecules on the surface, hydrocarbons or something, they oscillate around thermally activated, and that causes the electric fields to fluctuate. Right? That's kind of one hypothesis which seems to generally make sense. So there are some experiments also where people have put different surfaces near ions and not really found consistent results. But it's definitely clear that cooling the trap helps and cleaning the trap helps. So all these surface traps, for example, that I showed earlier, it's really kind of impossible to make them in a good quality in your own lab. All of the ones that have low heating rates are done in large foundries where they have a very controlled process for making this. That's kind of a challenge. This is why with this, I mean, this is, you know, not a commercial trap. I think if you want to do research in your trap, you want to, you know, hold a useful number of ions in your trap at a low heating rate and good optical access, I think that's the trap to do it in. It doesn't look like a computer chip, which is maybe the downside. But that's kind of what I'm trying to kind of circumvent. I'm trying to sidestep the issue you raised a little bit by sticking to these larger traps, I guess. Yeah. But it's partially understood, but not 100%, I would say. But I'd say from a practical point of view, people can make these traps now, and these traps can go down to maybe tens of quanta per second of heating rate, even though you're only 100 microns from the surface, which is very good, which is orders of magnitude better than what people did 20 years ago.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah. More questions? We have time for one last question, if you have one.
Oh, the chat is blinking.
Yeah. Optically.
Optically what? Optically.
Yeah, sorry, this is my question. I have some difficulty here. I think your last slide on connecting optically those ions to a telecom band was interesting. And also it's a challenge for Rydberg atom arrays. And it's been shown recently that alkaline earth atoms could be trapped and excite the Rydberg state and really quickly photoionized to prepare strontium 88 ions. So I was wondering if you could comment on the prospects of using combining the traps that you've shown here, those 3D traps with optical trapping, if there would be any benefits.
Yeah, in fact, there are a couple of experiments now that are doing this. One, I think, is Tobias Schretz in Germany, and the other is Jonathan Holm at ETH Zurich that are using optical traps for ions also. And that has the big advantage that it doesn't give you micromotion. And some examples, you know, some applications might really benefit from this. Because in all these RF traps, if your trap is not fully symmetric, if you have some stray fields, you get pushed off the micromotion null. You actually feel that RF field and the ions are jiggling around. And that might actually, if the trap is not fully harmonic, that can actually heat your ions, but also it can cause phase shifts and so on. And so there are experiments now underway for optical trapping of ions. So I think it has some advantages. It also has some big downsides. I mean, to me, the big advantage of a charge is that it gives you this strong force. So you can really make a nice deep trap. And that's an advantage over all the neutral atom experiments that are dealing with these shallow optical traps and the can't hold on to the ions, to the atoms very long. And the ions, if you can trap an ion for days and you don't need to reload, and you can take a lot of data without a reloading procedure. And I guess you probably give that up to some extent if you go to these shallow optical traps with the ions. But I think there are applications that are people now pursuing along those lines.
Okay, thank you.
All right. So then this officially concludes our question and answer session. Then again, thank you to everybody who asked questions, and like a big thank you to Norbert. It was an interesting talk. And yeah, that's a wrap. Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation. Thank you.